Waiting for that blue light.
There we go.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Thursday, March 31st meeting of the Senate Rules Committee. We have a very full agenda today and a full hearing room, so we're going to try to move as quickly as possible. And I'm going to start by opening a public hearing on SCR 5. And Erin, would you please tell us about this?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. SCR 5 declares June 19th to June 25th, 2011, Oregon Dance Week. There is a -2 amendment. It changes June to spring and deletes the date of Oregon Dance Week and inserts last week of April of each year. There is no revenue, no fiscal impact on the amendment.
Thank you, Erin. And I see Senator Bonamici, the sponsor of the bill, please come forward.
Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee, I'm State Senator Suzanne Bonamici from Senate District 17. Thank you so much for hearing Senate Concurrent Resolution 5 today. This resolution is about the importance of the arts, and it's a way to recognize the role of the arts in our culture and in our communities. It's to acknowledge the numerous talented dance organizations and also the importance of arts instruction. This is an idea that came about when I found out that there's a National Dance Week, and I thought this is a great way, without a funding request, to raise awareness of the arts. I wanted to let you know that I do support the -2 amendment to make the last week of April Oregon Dance Week, and that is in line with the timing of the National Dance Week, which, of course, we don't know every year when it will be, but it's as close as we could get. I know there are several professionals here. I am not a professional dancer. I let the committee know I did, however, take ballet when I was younger, and it meant a lot to me. I wish I would have continued it. You'll hear from some professional dancers today. But I did want to share a quote from the, I think you've all probably seen the movie Mr. Holland's Opus, which is a movie that was made in Oregon, and it's one of my favorite movies with regard to the importance of the arts. And there's a quote in there from Richard Dreyfuss, who played Mr. Holland, and there could actually be people in this building who were in this movie. I know a lot of Oregonians were in the movie. And this talks about the importance of the arts. He was talking about music, of course, but the arts in general. And he talked about responding to the principal of the school who wanted to cut the arts. And he said, well, I guess you can cut the arts as much as you want. Sooner or later, these kids aren't going to have anything to read or write about. And I really do believe, Chair Rosenbaum and committee, that the arts are an important part of the world that we live in, an important part of our culture and society, and to acknowledge the importance of the arts, and particularly dance as an art form, I encourage you to support Senate Concurrent Resolution 5 and the -2 amendments. And I would be happy to answer any questions, although the experts are here to testify on that. And I do also... Madam Chair, want to make sure. I don't know the protocol. I know typically with somebody who's going on to stage for a stage production, you say break a leg. I don't know if you say that to somebody who's in dance, so I'm not going to take that risk.
I bet we'll be able to ask that question to some of our other witnesses. So.
Thank you very much for hearing this this concurrent resolution. I believe it's important to acknowledge the arts. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
No questions?
For bringing this to us. Any questions for Senator Bonamici?
Thank you. And I'm next door in another committee, otherwise I'd stay and listen. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Don't break a leg. Thank you.
We can just close the public hearing.
Okay, and members of the audience, we're going to briefly close the public hearing because we do have another legislator on another bill who's on a tight time schedule, and then we will come back to this. So I'll close the public hearing on SCR 5 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 449. Erin, would you please tell us about that bill, and Senator Przanski, please come forward.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 449 creates a position of legislative ombudsman within the legislative department of state government, specifies selection process duties and authority of ombudsman, eliminates ombudsman services in Office of Children Advocate, Compensation and Conservation, Corrections, Oregon Health Authority, Manufactured Dwelling Park Community Relations, Injured Workers and Small Business, and DCBS, and transfers ombudsman's rights and obligations to the legislative ombudsman.
Good afternoon, Senator Pruszynski, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, colleagues, for allowing me to have a brief introduction for Senate Bill 449. The main presenter is going to be Tori Luke Klein. Many of you may remember her. She worked with my office previously before she made, I guess, somewhat of the mistake that seems like some of my aides end up going to law school. She is currently technically a third-year law student, but she has actually probably would be like a fifth-year law student because she's been so active and involved in various programs, double majoring, et cetera, at the school. And she is involved in a program, dispute resolution, negotiations, and negotiations and mediation program. She'll be able to give you the formal title, but from that work she's learned that it's very important to be able to have open and direct communications between individuals, and what she is going to be presenting today is an opportunity for us to be looking at what some other states have done. She has modeled after a couple of the states and is bringing forward what I would call the Oregon solution for ombudsmen to actually be much more efficient and effective in consolidating the work and being able to better serve our constituents, or ourselves as legislators, as well as the agencies that would be represented there. Senator Jackie Winters has also given her support and provided written testimony because of her duties with Ways and Means. She was not able to come down to testify at this time. So with that, I will ask you to please consider SB 449 and hear Ms. Klein as to the attributes of what we can actually do and accomplish with this type of program that will, in fact, be much more attentive to those that we serve, and also give us more insight in working with agencies and having agencies following and working closer with us as they serve not only the members, but more importantly, our constituents.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator Pruszynski. Any questions for the senator?
If I can be excused, Madam Chair?
Yes,
thank you.
Do. Okay. So we've got quite a few people signed up for SB 449. I think we're going to go through this witness list, and then we will come back to SCR 5. Okay, so next I will call Tori, I don't see that you signed up as a witness. Are you intending to testify? Oh, I see. You're signed up with Senator Pruszynski. Please come forward.
And I will say, as Tori comes forward, she did provide the testimony in advance, and it was in your packet, and it's also available on the S drive if you have your laptop today.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, as well as the members of the Rules Committee. Aaron has been inundated with letters of support that I've received from the other states that currently have state ombudsman legislative models like the one that Senate Bill 449 proposes, as well as a letter from a national organization that supports the work of ombuds services. For today, I'll tell you a little bit about myself, discuss what I feel are the benefits of this bill, and then open it up for questions for the four of you and perhaps fifth when we see Senator Burdick. Senator Burdick also signed on as one of the sponsors of the bill, along with Senator Winters and Senator Pruszynski. So I'll anticipate some questions, but not as many from her. As Senator Pruszynski mentioned, I'm Tori Klein, and I'm a third-year law student down at the University of Oregon School of Law. I've lived in Oregon almost my entire life since I was four. Currently, I live in Eugene. However, I've lived numerous other areas and also worked in other areas. My mother's actually a constituent of Senator Beyer. My grandparents are constituents of Senator Farioli. And I don't know if I know anyone down in Grants Pass, but I am friends with the people that started Dust Bros, so that started in the area. And then Portland's a place I frequent quite often, so it's an honor to talk with all of you senators today on this bill. As you may notice on the bill, I requested it to be drafted after I conducted extensive research on this concept of legislative ombudsman at the national level, what it looks like in general state governments. I looked into its benefits, appropriate provisions of authority, and much more. More recently, I conducted research to see how it would be viable or applicable in our great state. And after I examined this for about a year or so, I determined that the state of Oregon, its public servants, and its citizens could really benefit and truly need a legislative ombuds office for three main reasons. Those reasons are outlined in a one-pager you have before you, but I'd like to elaborate a little bit more on those and then answer any questions that you might have. First, I believe Senate Bill 449 is necessary to save the state money, and in this time, it's vital that we share resources and also increase efficiency of our dispute resolution processes we offer to citizens, both through prevention techniques and resolution assistance. And also, we have the potential to increase revenue for the state with this bill. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. The second reason that Senate Bill 449 is important for the state of Oregon is that it increases the effectiveness of services through a general jurisdiction office with true independence and without losing the specialized services in each area currently being served. The third very important reason is that this bill actually provides more ombudsman services to all the agencies and all of its citizens. I'll gladly discuss this greater positive impact in a moment. First of all, I want to touch on how this bill will present some cost savings to the state of Oregon. I know that Vice Chair Ferrioli recently stated that saving money means doing more with less and putting in hard work needed to find efficiencies. This is why we're all here today, and it's to discuss how we continue to save more money for Oregon through our hard work and at the same time increase services that we provide to Oregonians. Now, although these two phrases don't necessarily sit in the same sentence often, that's exactly what this bill seeks to do. Increase services, as well as save the state of Oregon money simultaneously upon passage and in the future. Now, this bill does that by joining current ombudsman staff under one legislative umbrella, which consolidates resources in a creative and functional manner, where people in the office can share policy analysts, share administrative staff, share IT support, while still focusing with deputy ombudsmen that would look into the specialized areas that we have is currently in the state, as well as where we can develop. A second way that this will save money is that it actually prevents costly litigation. Now, you'll see in your support letter from Pat Shanahan, who's Arizona Ombuds, he included an annual report, and he gives you proof of how it saved the state of Arizona money by preventing costly litigation. Because we all agree that solely reactive treatment isn't necessarily the best way to prevent costly litigation. It sometimes allows costly issues to resurface, and sometimes this basically takes time and money. The third way this will save money and actually increase funds is something that Arizona and numerous other states do with their legislative ombudsman office, and they allow the state to contract with city and counties who believe in and truly see the benefit of working with ombuds within their state government. Currently, Oregon has City of Portland ombuds Michael Mills, who was my mentor in a lot of my research in this, and I'm sure that he could discuss the ombudsman model at the government level if you have more questions. There are two other points that I can run through quickly. I know that we have a longer list of witnesses. So the second and one of the more important points is, why is this different? How is this different, and why do I believe, and why is it truly more effective for Oregonians, this model that Senate Bill 449 proposes? Well, transitioning to the collaborative model, this consolidated model, will increase effectiveness because it provides a single contact point for all citizens with concerns and complaints about branches of the government. Now, even those within agencies who may oppose this new model for various reasons have expressed that they actually find merit in an office that serves as one intake coordinator for all citizen complaints, that everyone knows exactly where to go to address concerns with the government. Secondly, this bill provides that the Legislative Ombudsman Office will have more independence than currently is existing with ombuds. This is vital, and this is one of the key differences to note. Currently, ombudsmen are selected by and report to agencies that they're supposed to investigate. The issue with this is that if a citizen like me has a concern with the agency and they don't get their needs met, how likely is it that me as a citizen, that citizen will go back to that exact agency to address the grievance? It's not that likely. It might happen in some situations, but that citizen will likely move to the next costly step, which is probably litigation, depending on the circumstances of the case. Now, Senate Bill 449's structural independence is a key difference between the current system and the proposed system, where it will move the office under the system of the legislature, where it will report to and not be actually managed by or directed by the legislature, which is key on this independence. It reports to a bipartisan group and further supports this idea of independence, because if citizens feel like they can get true, fair, and equitable responses and processes from the government, they're more likely to go to them, and they're less likely to receive, or they believe they're less likely to receive impartial and neutral assistance if they go to an employee of the agency that they're supposed to be investigating. There are other ways that this bill increases effectiveness, but I want to touch on one point and then ask you for any questions, which I'm sure you have some. The last thing I want to talk about is what Senator Prezonsky mentioned. Senator Prezonsky talked about how this increases services to agencies, and that's something that many agencies or boards or commissions don't necessarily see yet. Right now, we've got three great ombudsmen that are executive-type ombudsmen in the room for Oregon, and we have a few others that are in Section 11 of the bill that are or maybe not be actually ombudsman-type roles. There are 115 agencies, and I put it in quotes, defined in the ORSs, that could use services from an ombuds to really look into systemic changes, assist them in dealing with citizens, and also 115 agencies, nearly, that could utilize these services to serve their constituents better. These additional means of government accountability further the health of government and truly support our your constituents and our citizens' public welfare. Now, I know that your work days are long, and I've talked a lot. Especially during session, we want to keep it short. So I thank you very much for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of this bill that will save Oregon money and also improve the welfare of its people. So if you have any questions, I'd love to answer them at this time.
Thanks very much for your testimony. Any questions? Looks like you've answered them all.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and next I'll call John Mullen and Tim Baxter. If you both would like to come up, please do so.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center here today to raise a number of concerns about Senate Bill 449. First of all, there are a number of general concerns about the separation of powers, some efficiency issues, and practical considerations. My colleague Tim Baxter, who's here with me today, has done some analysis of that bill, and he'll have some additional comments, so I will limit my comments in that area. I also believe the committee has received some information from the departments about their various programs, which I'm sure that you will have an opportunity to review if you haven't done so before. I do, though, want to speak to a couple of the programs. The Oregon Law Center works on behalf of low-income people, and a couple of those programs are really vital to the functioning of the Oregon Law Center and our colleagues around the state. Back in the 2009 session, a number of us worked together with the governor's office to create an ombudsman position in what has now become the Oregon Health Authority with the passage of House Bill 2009 last session. The position was approved as part of that budget, and we spent hours and hours working with DHS and the governor's office about what that position should be about and how it should function. We also were cognizant of the fact that in 2009 there was discussion about greatly increasing the number of people covered under the Oregon Health Plan, both the standard program and Healthy Kids. And so we felt it was really necessary to make sure that we had an ombudsman function in the Oregon Health Authority. Now, the Oregon Health Authority is the Medicaid authority for the state, and that's important for how that position is funded. As the Medicaid authority, there are funds that come through the provider tax that are matched for Medicaid to fund this position. If Senate Bill 449 was to become law, that funding mechanism would go away. So while Ms. Klein talks about ways in which this would save money, at least in this position, there would be no way to reconstruct that particular kind of function. And we're very concerned about that because we feel that program is working very successfully and well. The second program I want to talk about is the Governor's Advocacy Office, and just mention this briefly as well. It was created back in the 1993 session, and later the Child Ombudsman program was moved into that program. And the two of them are functioning efficiently and well together, and they're funded, also funded uniquely with a number of fees relating to birth certificates, adoption, and divorce certificates. And this is, again, another program that for our field offices, we feel very strongly about these positions. Ms. Klein mentioned about avoiding litigation. We also look at this as a way in which clients can receive services and have their needs and issues met where they're happening. So we feel these functions, two functions, are working very well. The final note I want to make is that this has been a very busy session with a lot of things going on. The whole healthcare restructuring discussion, transformation, the early childhood design. I would just point out that those efforts have really been fully engaged by stakeholders. There have been numerous meetings. I've been at a number of them myself, and have involved a broad range of people working together on trying to figure out how to do the best with transforming major systems. I would say that while I've had an opportunity to meet with Ms. Klein and find her to be very, very bright, capable, and provided some very good feedback and discussion back and forth, we have had no similar engagement of broad groups of stakeholders. So for those reasons, I think overall about the efficiencies, how the programs are working well, the significance of doing a restructure like this, I would just say that if something like this is encouraged in the future to look at ways in which ombudsman functions could be done better, and we would always want to be at the table to have those kinds of discussions. But I have to say that I don't feel that Senate Bill 449 is the way to go. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Baxter.
Thank you. Excuse me, Chair Rosenbaum, Vice Chair Ferrioli, my name, members of the committee. My name is Tim Baxter. I'm a staff attorney for Lane County Legal Aid. We also oppose Senate Bill 449, and we feel that Mr. Mullen has covered our position quite well. I have submitted some written testimony concerning some features of 449. Let me just say now that this bill, if enacted, would give one lone legislative officer the ability to pick up subpoenas and on her own motion, and really under the terms of the bill, for just about any reason, go into any executive branch agency and investigate its day-to-day functions. I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but that seems like a lot of power. And there are at least some serious questions, I think, that would be raised by this kind of a program as to bridging the two different branches of government. On the other side of the coin, Ms. Klein testified that there were 115 state agencies that this ombudsman would have authority over. Those agencies deal with every conceivable kind of subject matter, including some that are quite technical and that would demand quite a bit of expertise. In the case that I know about, which is the Oregon Health Plan, if you're going to work with the Oregon Health Plan or with a matter concerning the health plan, you need to have a pretty sophisticated knowledge of Medicaid law, and just as important, of how that law is administered by the managed care plans. And you need to know the people that are running those programs. I am concerned that 449 would have a harmful impact on the Oregon Health Plan. Mr. Mullen has talked about the fiscal aspect and the fact that abolishing the health authority ombudsman would save no money, because you're talking about two different funding streams here, so there's really no bang for the buck. In terms of the health authority ombudsman, she took office last fall, and she has really put a shoulder into the shovel to get at systems of health plan performance monitoring. Advocates have been really extremely grateful to see the way in which she has taken up very intensively the matter of how health plan service performance is tracked, how it's trended, and how it's reported out. I think that realistically speaking, if you've got an ombuds function that is responsible for every agency in the state, you're just not going to be able to bring that kind of resource to bear on systemic problems. I have looked at the few other states that have this kind of program. They operate intake systems that process individual complaints, literally thousands of them a year. It's basically volume work. And it may be a useful function for the state to have, and certainly Ms. Klein, who has a bright future, I think, is to be commended for bringing this concept to this level of public attention. But it's not a program we can afford right now, and I don't think it's ever going to be a program we could afford if it comes at the expense of programs like the Health Authority Ombudsman and the Children's Ombudsman. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Farrioli.
I'd like to just check an assumption that I seem to be hearing here, and what I'm assuming is that you believe that the ombudsperson would need to know the services and the legal framework in which all state agencies operate under in order to be effective. Is that what I'm hearing? You know, you said that this person would have to be a generalist and sort of omniscient in their ability to understand the complexities of a wide variety of laws in order to be effective.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think in some cases that would not be the case, but certainly in some cases it would be. I don't know how you value real property, but I see that one of the ombuds programs here that would be abolished is the Conservation and Compensation Ombudsman, and I believe that has to do with the taking of property and how you compensate. That's technical, I think, and I don't know how a generalist office would be able to address that problem.
Madam Chair, if I might push back a little.
Question?
Yeah.
My
understanding is that the people administering programs for the state of Oregon, the state employees and their directors and their managerial staff and their line officers and the people providing the direct services are the people that we expect to be the experts. And that the ombudsman or ombudsperson in this case has one function only, and that's to review actions taken by the agency to assure that the agency followed its own rules and regulations, did so in a fair and equitable manner, did so in consideration of the goals and objectives of the agency and the Oregon Revised Statutes. Now, those things, that is an approach to providing a service that doesn't require any special knowledge of the esoteria of any individual agency. It's, look, I have a complaint. We're not here just to say howdy and trash through your files. You failed to deliver the service that was expected. And the attempt to get that resolved by going to your agency through the front door and kicking it upstairs and doing the administrative work that should be done has failed. And so now I've been asked to come and look at the trail, the document trail, and the fact set that were created in this contact. Let's look at that to make sure that you did fulfill the functions of your agency. And if not, perhaps you could tell us how it is that you will remedy that situation. That's my understanding of what an ombudsperson does. Is that different from your understanding?
Madam Chair, Senator Farrioli, I think there are ombudspersons and there are ombudspersons. And certainly...
The distinction.
Yeah. could be a valuable function in this sort of case disposition mode of being an ombudsperson. But ombudspersons, and I'll just stick with what I know, which is the Oregon Health Authority Ombudsman, is concerned not just with individual cases. You can get the same complaint over and over again, and you can solve it 100 times, but if you don't go to the system that is causing the complaints to occur, you are not going to get any headway. And so, at least in the case of the Oregon Health Authority Ombudsman, she's going to root causes that cause the individual complaints.
Madam Chair, just one other observation.
Yeah, an observation would be great, and then we've got several other people.
Yeah, then I think I'll be satisfied with that. Well, I think you've just made a really strong case for having an ombudsperson housed in the legislative branch for this reason. Getting at the root cause many times means changing legislative direction, clarifying a policy, changing an Oregon revised statute, charging the agency with redirection, and that happens in this building in the legislative branch. So, you know, I thank you for making that point because I think it tends to support the idea that you would have an ombudsperson housed in the legislative branch. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you for your testimony. And next I'll call Chris Davey and Crystal Sherman. After that, Steve Lanning and Chuck Carpenter. Good afternoon. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Chris Davey with Safe Corporation. And let me start off by telling you what we're not here to do today, and that is that we're not here to take a position on the creation of an ombudsman's function within the legislative branch. What we want to do is to talk about the excellent work that is performed by the Injured Worker Ombudsman and the Small Business Ombudsman within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And the Small Business Ombudsman advises employers, just as the Injured Worker Ombudsman advises injured workers about navigating the labyrinth of the workers' compensation system. We're concerned that these positions might be eliminated, in fact, would be eliminated by the passage of this bill, and that those functions would be absorbed into this general ombudsman's office. I sat down and thought of maybe half a dozen reasons why I don't think it's a good idea to make that move, but I really only want to talk about one of them in the interests of time, and that is the subject that's already been discussed here this afternoon about there being ombudsman and ombudsman. And I think there may be some confusion about the functions that are performed at DCBS because the Injured Worker and Small Business Ombudsman are not investigating complaints about the agency in which they're housed. They are really helping people to resolve questions and disputes between themselves and between the parties that are bringing those questions and the insurance companies who are involved in managing the workers' compensation policies and providing benefits to injured workers. Maybe the problem is that the term ombudsman should never have been applied to those people at DCBS because as I looked at the insurance division's website, they have a person who's called the consumer advocate. And when I compared the responsibilities of that position with the responsibilities of the workers' compensation ombudsman, I see that they're very similar. They are to answer questions, help solve problems, help to mediate disputes, and so on. And so perhaps we should have called the workers' compensation ombudsman workers' compensation advocates, and then we wouldn't be having this conversation. So given that they are really consumer advocate positions, I'm not sure that they belong in this legislative ombudsman office that is described in Senate Bill 449. Now, with me today is Crystal Sherman. Crystal is a claims adjuster at Safe Corporation who deals with the Injured Worker Ombudsman's office on a daily basis. And Crystal is also one of several Safe employees who are learning more about the legislative process this session, and this is her first time before a committee, and she'll have a few words about her daily interactions with the ombudsman's office.
Great. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Crystal Sherman, and I'm a compensability adjuster at Safe Corporation. That basically means that when an injured worker files a claim, that I either do the accepting of their claim or the denying of their claim. I'm here today as an enthusiastic supporter of the Injured Worker Ombudsman. Their office is staffed with experienced advocates, well-versed in the intricacies of Oregon workers' comp. I refer to their office multiple times each week because they are an unbiased expert that a worker can use as a resource on their claim. It is important for injured workers to have access to an ombudsman who is
not just familiar with Oregon workers' comp, but who is an actual expert in Oregon workers' comp, because this is what the this is what an injured worker has to wade through when they file a claim. These are the laws on Oregon workers' comp, and these are the administrative rules that govern how an injured worker's claim is actually processed. It's general practice at SAFE that a worker who isn't represented by an attorney will be referred to the ombudsman anytime a settlement is being discussed. We do that because the ombudsman offers an unbiased opinion to the injured worker and can act as a resource to them to help them decide if a settlement is in their best interest or not, and help them understand what benefits they might be losing in a settlement. Last week, I had a coworker do a $60,000 settlement for an unrepresented worker. That worker, with the ombudsman's assistance, came to the conclusion that the settlement was in their best interest, and because they did that without an attorney, with the ombudsman's help, they were able to keep $8,500 in their own pocket that would have gone to an attorney fee. I use the ombudsman often in cases where I issue a denial. I regularly refer them to the ombudsman because the ombudsman is an unbiased party who can really explain their options to them when I issue a denial and help them weigh whether or not to appeal my decision and whether or not they need to have attorney representation. Every time I refer a worker to the ombudsman, I have absolute faith that the ombudsman will understand the specifics of the case and be able to offer appropriate help to the injured worker because they are experts in Oregon workers' comp law. As experts, the ombudsman's office is the most capable party to assist workers with disputes on their claim. I have seen them employ several techniques to assist injured workers in resolving disputes. I've actually had ombudsman personnel call me and act as a mediator between myself and an injured worker. I've seen them resolve a worker's concern simply by telling them that my decision or action was appropriate on their claim, and because they are an unbiased party, the worker places value on that, and that resolves their concern. I've also had them advise workers that they have a valid dispute and should pursue an appeal with or without the assistance of an attorney. The current injured worker ombudsman provides injured workers with expert, unbiased advice, and I encourage this committee to ensure that injured workers will continue to receive the same level of service and experience in the future. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
And Madam Chair, if yes. I could just add, I think there is over 200 years of experience in the two ombudsman's offices dealing with workers' compensation at DCBS, and we would hate to see that be lost or diluted by absorbing that into this legislative ombudsman process. I think the results for injured workers and other stakeholders would be the less timely resolution of disputes and a less satisfactory conclusion to those disputes. So, In the words of the old saying, as far as we're concerned, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And we'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. And, Crystal, I understand this is the first time you've testified in front of
yes.
the legislature.
Thank you.
So you did a great job.
Thank you very
any
much.
Any questions? Okay.
Thank you
both for being here today. And finally, I'll call Steve Lanning and Chuck Carpenter, if you'd both like to come forward. I know you're not together, but I'm sure you can sit together. Whichever of you would like to go first, please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. I'm only speaking on a piece of Senate Bill 449, the piece that deals with the Ombudsman for Injured Workers Office. We're opposed to Senate Bill 449. The Ombudsman for Injured Workers does a critical job for workers in the state, and our office probably refers more injured workers, union reps, and others to their office than we do to BOLI, probably. As far as calls coming into our office, we're always referring to that office. The one thing I want to mention, I don't think it's been mentioned yet, is that this office was created in 1987, 3 years before the workers' comp reform took place. It was sort of a historical reform. I know that it wasn't unanimous on labor's part, but we overwhelmingly supported the reform in 1990, and it's resulted in a lot of savings in the workers' comp system. But the one thing that we all have been doing since then is we've been participating through any change in the workers' comp system or even in this office, anything having to do with workers' comp, through the Management Labor Advisory Committee, and where there's five labor reps and five business reps on that committee. And when it pertains to workers' compensation changes, that's the committee that takes a look at it. And we've got an agreement that we've had for 20 years. If MLAC takes a position on something, that's the AFL-CIO's position on it as well. If there's no position, then we can go out and do whatever we're going to do in this building. But we've had that agreement for 20 years. And we recognize that MLAC is going to take a look at Senate Bill 449 next week, and we'll be taking a look at their recommendation. And we would also like this committee to do the same thing if they do have a recommendation as well. And if this bill is going to move forward and MLAC doesn't have a recommendation or whatever, then we think that this piece regarding the Ombudsman for Injured Workers needs to be amended out if it's going to move forward. We think that their current bureaucratic position in DCBS is a good fit. They're sort of a step back from policy making here at the legislature in the role that they do, and we think that's a good fit for them. They're an efficient office. We've had a lot of good responses from unions and injured workers about calling their office and getting what they need, and we'd hate to see anything change. And the last thing I'd like to say is that if we thought this would be a better deal for injured workers, if it would provide a more efficient office, if it would save money, we'd be supporting it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and please go ahead.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chuck Carpenter. I'm Executive Director of Manufactured Housing Communities of Oregon. Basically, echoing a lot of the comments that have been made here earlier, we're in opposition to 449, mainly because the Manufactured Home Communities Resource Center, we'd like to have that amended out of the bill. And as someone has mentioned earlier, we're not here to sort of endorse one way or the other the legislature's having a general legislative ombudsman. We feel that with the program, with this resource center for manufactured housing, they play a very important role for us in the manufactured home community industry, in that they are a neutral party that both residents and landlords can go to get unbiased information. They've done an excellent job over the years providing that information. As all of you know who've dealt with these issues, this is an area of landlord-tenant law that is fraught with conflict and tension, and it's nice to have an agency that we can go to have some of these issues resolved. We don't see this center as being an ombudsman program. We see it as a great resource for the industry, and we would like to have them amended out, and that is why we're a no vote on, or a no on Senate Bill 449.
Okay, thank you both for your testimony. Any questions, Senator Farioli? Okay, thank you very much for being here. Okay, and we have several pieces of written testimony that will become part of the record, so Erin's going to just briefly.
Yes, we received written testimony from Duncan Fowler, from Robin Matsuniga, from Ruth Cooper Ryder, from the United States Ombudsman Association Board of Directors, and the Ombudsman Standards Packet. We received testimony from Linda Lord Jenkins and Patrick Shanahan, and the Arizona Ombudsman Annual Report from Bill Angrick and Drew Johnson. We have written testimony received this afternoon from DAS, from Marjorie Taylor. We also just received testimony from Bob Junif at Disability Rights of Oregon.
Okay, thank you, Erin, and thank you, Ms. Klein, for all the work that has gone into this. You've certainly given us a lot to think about. Thank you to everybody who came to testify on Senate Bill 449. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 449. And I'll reopen the public hearing on Senate Concurrent Resolution 5. And we have several people signed up to testify, and so I'm going to call them in groups, starting with Tricia Mead, Cassandra Gruner, and Adam Hartley, if the three of you would like to come forward. Thank you for waiting so patiently. We have to jump around a little occasionally here. Thanks for being here, and welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Should I go first?
Yes, please. Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and legislators present. My name is Tricia Mead, and I am the Marketing and Communications Director for Oregon Ballet Theater. I'm here today in support of the bill to create an Oregon Dance Week. In 1857, Oregonians celebrated our fledgling statehood with a dance, an inaugural ball hosted at the Willamette Woolen Mills, just right here in Salem. 2,000 years before that, Native American tribes were meeting on the banks of the Columbia River Gorge to trade, share news, and most importantly, dance together. We dance at weddings, basketball games, bat mitzvahs, on the streets of V-Day, and crowded high school gyms in Prineville, salsa clubs in East Multnomah County, and ballet schools large and small all over our state. Some of us devote our lives to sharing dance with others. The dancers of Oregon Ballet Theater impact over 100,000 Oregonians every year through our performances, touring, and outreach. But it would be a mistake to think of dance as something that is reserved only for people who can afford the performances or attend the classes. Why? Barbara Ehrenreich describes dance as an expression of collective joy. It is through the dance that we share emotions and experiences too intense and joyful to be expressed any other way. A father's first dance with her new bride, a ballerina's star turn in Swan Lake, the backyard backstreet rhythm of any given summer Saturday, and the dancing in the streets after a victory, either on the football field or in the voting booth. You will hear testimony today from dancers and educators around the state who will tell you how dance transforms their lives, how it increases attendance, improves health, and inspires kids to use not just the one-tenth of their bodies that resides behind their eyeballs, but their whole bodies when they learn. These are fantastic reasons to support Oregon Dance Week. But also consider this. Your choice to designate an official Oregon Dance Week is a provocative act of public joy, a proud declaration in honor of celebration in all its forms, and an invitation to the people of this state for 1 week to step away from their laptops, their iPhones, their iPads, put down their equipment, and just dance. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and Chairwoman and the legislators present. I appreciate being here and having the opportunity to speak today about my passion about dance and dance for Oregonians. My name is Cassandra Gruner. I was born in Astoria, Oregon, into a first-generation Finnish community. My first dance memory is of dancing the polka with my grandpa in the kitchen, who was a retired logger. I took my first ballet classes in Astoria. I've danced ever since, more than 50 years of dancing, and I have a BA in dance, I have a master's degree in education, and in the 70s and 80s I toured as a performer with companies as a teaching artist in dance funded by the National Endowments for the Arts. But my husband and I came back to Oregon to live in 1989 to raise our small children here, and my son just graduated from University of Oregon. When I came back to Oregon, I hoped to give back something of what I had gained growing up here. Specifically, I wanted to help children have the enrichment of dance experiences, either to do it themselves or to learn enough to appreciate and enjoy watching it. I have worked for OBD since 1991, and I'm now the Education and Outreach Director there, providing educational services to 27,000 people, over 9,000 of which are students. I support the esteemed Senator Bonamici's introduction of Senate Concurrent Resolution 5, which calls for the state to establish Oregon Dance Week, because such a resolution would raise Oregonians' public awareness of dance in all its incarnations, from exercise that utilizes the full body, is life-affirming, and can be done anywhere, to dance as an art form with specific training and techniques that are performed in civic and private venues to be either experienced as a participant or as an observer. Such a resolution sends a message to Oregonians that dance is valid, to be experienced by all who wish. As an art educator, I speak from the knowledge that schools are struggling to evaluate student achievement and that public agencies such as Young Audiences and Portland's Regional Art and Culture Council, which administer such programs as the Right Brain Initiative, are collaborating with schools to integrate arts into the academic day because it has long been known that the arts are not a fringe activity. To quote Michelle and Robert Root Bernstein, "The arts foster innovation. Almost all Nobel laureates in the sciences actively engage in the arts as adults. They are 25 times as likely as the average scientist to sing, dance, or act. In Max Planck's words, the creative scientist needs an artistic imagination. Dance is the least served art form in schools, yet kinesthetic learners abound. Literally, they are bounding around the classroom with no place for all that energy. When I go into schools, I am met with two types of teachers and students, those who are gung-ho for dance and those who are resistant. I am really interested in why people are resistant. There is not time here to speak about all the research and reasons that I think creates that resistance in both teachers and students, but the best part is, once we start dancing in a school, things change. Resistant students loosen up and have fun seeing things, what their bodies can do. Boys move softly, girls move powerfully. They are challenged, which is so essential for learning. At the theater, students applaud, smile, and gasp every time a dancer amazes them with grace and exceptional skill. They forget their resistance, mostly because, I believe, their resistance was based in the fear of not knowing really what dance is or the variety of dance that is possible. An Oregon Dance Week would also align with a new program now in its strategic planning stage in the Portland metropolitan area. The program is called Any Given Child and is a partnership with the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, aimed to create a long-range arts education plan for students in grades K-8. We are the third partner community in the United States. It's a great honor. The other cities are Sacramento, California, and Springfield, Illinois. I'm honored to serve on that planning committee. Any Given Child strives to provide equitable access to the arts for all students, and I see it as a model that could grow in our state using existing things that we already have here. An Oregon Dance Week would provide a wonderful frame for all ages to celebrate dance, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you.
Thank you for your comments. And Adam, please go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum and legislators. My name's Adam Hartley. I'm an apprentice with Oregon Ballet Theater. I just wanted to talk really shortly about what dance means to me and the importance that I feel in bringing it to the community around me. Where I grew up, there wasn't a significant awareness and support for the arts, especially dance, as there is here in Oregon. I got into dance through my sisters, and it's not something at a young age that I ever thought I would do as a career. But it's something that slowly grew on me and became a part of me, because it takes full dedication of your time and heart to dance from 9:30 to 8 every day. And if you truly love it, you realize that it's more than just a career. It's your whole life. And that's what makes it such a beautiful art, and I've never experienced anything more gratifying than being able to express myself through movement and hopefully reach people on all different levels. And more importantly, as a male dancer, I feel a certain pride and responsibility in bringing my art to younger audiences, especially young boys who may have some inclination towards the arts or dancing. And I feel that it's important for me to show them that this is something that boys do and is okay for boys to do. And although it's hard work, it can be extremely gratifying to perform for your community and bring joy to the lives of the people around you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your comments, and thank you for being here. OBT has got its headquarters right in the heart of Senate District 21, which is my Senate district, so I was really delighted when it moved there and have really been a big fan for a long time, and I'm glad to see the organization flourishing so much. So it's great to have you here today, and I was going to ask you, since the break a leg do dancers say break a leg?
Oh, you would never say break a leg. That would be terrible. You say something that's a little bit not great for the chambers. You say merd.
Merd, ah.
Or you go on stage. That's what's said all the time.
Great.
Look it up. It's French.
Merci.
Pas du quoi.
Any questions, Senator Ferrioli?
Ma'am, thank you. If the resolution is adopted, what special events do you believe might be staged or offered during Oregon Dance Week?
We're just in the planning stages for how we might employ that with our partner organizations around the state. But some ideas that have been effectively done at the national level and in other states where they have a dance week have included opening up free ballet and other forms of dance classes for the week to give people the opportunity to come together and give dance a try. Two major public dance celebrations in Pioneer Courthouse Square, to making dance videos available through daily dance breaks that can be distributed through people's collective emails and listservs. So there's a variety of public and private ways that we would encourage people to celebrate the dance for the week, and if the bill were to move forward, then we would very quickly coalesce some activities and coordinate with our Regional Arts and Culture Council, the Oregon Cultural Trust, and the Oregon Arts Commission to disseminate what those opportunities are to Oregonians around the state.
Okay.
Great. And I do seem to remember an opening ceremony in the Senate chamber a few years ago that actually was done by Oregon Ballet Theater. I was really amazed at the time because they actually set up a very small elevated stage and performed work that I guess was designed for a small space such as ours. So I think there are all sorts of creative possibilities that could certainly bring joy and some real creativity.
And certainly since it's occurring during school time, there are so many opportunities for schools to have, like, everybody in the whole state dancing at the same time would be, like, the craziest fun event in the world.
With this year being the first potential Oregon Dance Week, I'm sure that the initial efforts would be small, but by making it into perpetuity the way that the bill has been amended, that would give us the opportunity to really grow it from year to year to create more and more public celebrations of dance.
Great. Well, thank you again for being here. And we have two more witnesses, and I'll call them together, Valerie Berkman and Riley Grannon. Thank you for waiting so patiently, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for hearing our testimony, Chair Rosenbaum and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Bergman. Along with my husband, Daryl Thomas, I am the artistic director of the Rainbow Dance Theater, which is a little bit unique in Oregon in that it's based in a rural community in Monmouth. My husband and I moved here about 14 years ago from the New York area, and it was a bit of a shock. We went from a dance community of 5,000 plus to a full community of 5,000 plus. And we wondered what was it that we could do in that situation, being more used to being on stage as performing artists. And over the years, what we found is that we could use dance to build communities, not just of dancers, but of communities across the board. We go into schools doing our show, The Roots of Hip Hop, which teaches young children about the African American culture. We go into prisons and juvenile facilities to give a dance experience to those children and those men who are incarcerated. We go into situations all over the state that are unusual for a dance company. And what we've found through the years is that there is a community that's built through dance, and we believe that that's what the Dance Week could foster, is dance activities that go from community to community and build a bond in that. We believe that dance is in all of us and for all of us, not something just in a darkened theater, but something for young children who delight in dancing as soon as there's music put on anywhere. It's for teens that are going to YouTube and learning the latest dance steps so that they can be at the high school dance and bust a move. And it's for all of those people together who go to weddings, who dance together as a community with contra dances, folk dances, and salsa. And it's the pride of a child from a school residency who does the steps that his ancestors did many years ago and realizes that he has a cultural history, she has a cultural history, and they've learned that through dance. Our dance company performs for 2,000-seat theaters on tour. We also perform in gymnasiums, and we also come in close contact with community by doing work with youth that are at risk. And this is an important piece of what we do. Right now, we have two young boys from the Corvallis area who have joined our men dancing group, both of whom were struggling in high school, about to drop out. And through the arts, they've become inspired, their self-esteem has grown, their grades have risen, and they're just two of many, many children which are affected by dance. The Ashanti people in West Africa have a saying, and we say this to tens of thousands of children every year in our school assemblies. The Ashanti people say, when we move together, when we dance together, we are as one great people, or one big community. And we really believe that dance brings everyone together. We all have danced. We may not remember. It may be so far in our past that we don't remember. Yet every day that you walk down the street, you're dancing. Every time that you put something away into a cupboard, you're dancing. Dance is movement in space and time. We do it all the time. And a dance week would allow us to honor the dancer in all of us, and for all of us to move together as one great community at the same time and in the same state. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And before we hear from our next witness, I see that Senator Devlin is in the audience. He's here on another bill. We are on our last witness on this bill. Are you able to stay with us?
Yes, Madam Chair, and I believe Senator Morris was going to be joining me.
We were expecting him to, so. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, please go ahead.
Senator Rosenbaum, committee members, in that spirit, I'll keep it brief. My name is Riley Grant, and I'm managing director of the Eugene Ballet Company, and I also live in Senator Byers' district. You may not know about the impact of our organization in the state, but we've been, since the late 70s, dynamic organizations performed statewide, spreading the spirit of dance and what we do. We've toured to over 100 cities in 32 states, from Anchorage, Alaska to Daytona Beach, Florida, Beckley, West Virginia to Escondido, California, and internationally through the State Department to India, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Syria, Jordan, Tunisia, Canada. So we've been a very active organization. And behind what we do, it's always been about access. And I defy any Oregon senator to say I live in a district where the Eugene Ballet is not performed. A quick, but not complete, list of the cities where we performed include Eugene, Corvallis, Salem, Roseburg, Cottage Grove, Albany, Lebanon, Sweet Home, Medford, Klamath Falls, Lakeview, Paisley, Baker City, Hermiston, Pendleton, LeGrand, The Dalles, Joseph, Enterprise, Bend, Redmond, Elgin, Imnaha, Astoria, Florence, Newport, Cannon Beach, Lincoln City, Myrtle Point, and Portland. We're delighted that the legislature is considering this opportunity to recognize dance in this state. My colleagues here have wonderful organizations they work for, and as we can feel in this state, this Dance Week provides us an opportunity to, again, do a little evangelizing. In Eugene, we plan to work together and do a gala with seven other organizations, which range from English country dancing to hip-hop to, we even have a recently relocated Samoan who's on the football team who plans to do a fire dance if requested. So we will do what we can to spread the word. This is a remarkable opportunity for us to not only show what we've accomplished here in the state of Oregon, but use this as a springboard for further recognition of dance in this state. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much for your testimony, both of you. Thanks for being here and for all the great work you do for our state and our community. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. And I'll close the public hearing on SCR 5. I'll open a work session on SCR 5. And Senator Farioli, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendment for SCR 5.
Senator Farioli moves the -2 amendment into Senate Concurrent Resolution 5. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair, for the record and those listening, could we have committee staff briefly summarize the -2s?
Yes, Senator Farioli, SCR 5 changes June to spring and deletes date that is specified in the current resolution and inserts last week of April of each year.
So, Madam Chair, the amendment means that the rights of spring have moved. Move the -2 amendments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Farioli. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Any objection? Amendment is adopted. Senator Farioli, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that SCR 5 is amended to the floor with a do adopt recommendation.
Senator Farioli moves SCR 5 to the floor with a do adopt recommendation. I'll point out there is no revenue and no fiscal impact on the bill. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator
Declare
Atkinson.
Declare potential conflict of interest.
I can't wait to hear this.
This last fall, my wife danced with the Rogue Valley Dancing with the Stars. She won a People's Choice Award, and our family is now involved in dance.
Very, very impressive conflict of interest. You'll note it for the record. Any further discussion? Is there any objection? Okay, hearing none, motion carries. And we need a carrier. Senator Bonamici, would you be willing to carry this on the floor?
I'd be honored to. Thank you. Madam
Great.
Chair.
Thank you. And I'll close the work session on SCR 5. Thank you to everyone who came to testify today. We'll look forward to action on the floor. And I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 739. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739. We'll come back to that and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 676. And I see we have both Senator Morris and Senator Devlin here to testify on this. Erin, could you briefly tell us what it does?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 676 directs Oregon Department of Administrative Services and Governor to submit continuous improvement level state budget based on performance management and performance measurement techniques, specifies content of budget, allows Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Emergency Board, Legislative Fiscal Office to review performance management and performance management processes for services contracted by state agencies and school districts, directs Governor and Chief Justice to report to Legislative Assembly on plan to implement continuous improvement strategies, declares emergency is effective upon passage.
Thank you, Erin. And welcome to the Senate Rules Committee, to both of you, and Senator Devlin as its former chair. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Whoever wishes to go first, please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, colleagues. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator from District 8, Albany and Corvallis areas. This is an issue that I believe the legislature has struggled with for years and years and decades. And that is, from a legislative perspective, how do we help government do a better job? And particularly in the environment that we're in today, when we have limited revenues and we're looking at more critically at efficiencies and processes, how can we change that paradigm? And what I would like to share with you is an experience that I had with a small agency. I happened to sit on as an advisory member on a board for that agency. The person that is responsible for the financial part of the agency was reporting on the budget being submitted for the governor's recommended budget. And with some degree of a little bit of discomfort. And so it dawned on me that it would be helpful to look at the budget instruction documents that come from the Department of Administrative Services to the agencies. And Madam Chair, colleagues, this is the document. And it's interesting, if you look within the, read every page of that document, what you don't see within that document is that driving force, the requirement when budgets are prepared to reflect measures of improvement and how greater efficiencies can be achieved at less cost. Further within that document, it's interesting, if you look in the glossary of terms, and that's a very important part of the document, what you see is virtually no reference to key performance measurements, even. While in the document, there is one page that deals with key performance measurements. So what this bill does, Madam Chair and colleagues, is that it's a transformational bill. It has the potential to be a transformational bill for state government and how it operates. And rather than maintaining what I would call a, more of a status quo position, you have, and essentially I think that's been embedded in state government for quite some time, is that what you have been doing is what you shall do in the future, and we will roll up the costs in what is called, we know, as current service level. And we have now found ourselves in a situation where that system just isn't working anymore. And this bill is brought forward at the request of the Committee on Performance Excellence. And you'll remember that as Senate Bill 1099 that we passed out. And you'll hear testimony from Fred King, who is the chair, and also Mike Jordan, the new chief operating officer for our state, to testify as well. As I've told Senator Devlin, my goal is that this bill would be referred from rules to ways and means, and that it is a work in progress. How do we improve it and make it work better? And that's my commitment to Senator Devlin to be a part of that process. I thank you very much for this hearing, and hopefully that we can get this bill down to where Senator Devlin and his colleagues on Ways and Means can improve it. And with that, Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Senator Morse. Madam Chair, it does feel a little bit unusual to be appearing before this committee. I trust that my colleagues on this committee that were here with me will not use the opportunity of this committee to ask the questions that they already have asked many times. But just to show you in a sense of how policy-driven I can be, I came to this bill from a slightly different direction than Senator Morse, but with a common purpose, because I think we both share some of the similar beliefs. This bill, by way of background information of why I have this interest and to tell you that I'm actually the policy geek that some people think that I am, until a few years ago, I served on a commission that only existed for a limited period of time to produce a product actually for all public entities throughout the United States, and was made up of practically every national organization you can imagine, and that was the National Performance Management Advisory Committee. What they produced was a document that literally went out to all cities, counties. The state treasurers were involved, state comptrollers were involved, basically to talk about the importance of performance-based management and to talk about the necessity of addressing these issues in light of the new realities that we face at actually all levels of government. I won't go into all the details of the bill, although my staff has spent a great deal of time actually preparing testimony for me, and I feel kind of embarrassed because I was just getting ready a few minutes ago to testify before the Education Committee, and they opened a hearing and opened a work session simultaneously and sent the bill out that they had prepared 2 days for me to testify on, to Ways and Means.
Okay.
So, but I won't get you into all the details. I just want to say in particular, performance measurement has been a part of this state for a longer period of time than most people realize. We were once considered a leader in this area. In fact, there is evidence that in Oregon that some of these issues go back 50 years within this state. Now, this may have some level of controversy, but we all know about Oregon Shines and the Oregon Progress Board. We also know that we defunded the Oregon Progress Board in the last session. But at the same time, I think everyone here knows that the Oregon Secretary of State has taken up that mantle to continue some of those efforts. What I have seen during this time of actual difficulty for the state is that we have lost sight of some of the efforts that we have already made. Performance measurement is fine. I mean, lots of people measure performance. Far too often, they measure outputs rather than measuring outcomes. It's far easier to measure outputs than it is outcomes. Obviously, I'll give you the classic example of that. How many people go through a drug and alcohol program is an output. How many people actually have a problem 5 years down the road is an outcome. The necessity in this is we were on a track to move basically from performance measurement to performance-based budgeting, which is actually what we were heavily involved in, which we've moved a little bit away from in the ways and means process, and we may need to move farther back close to that. We also need to realize that really the time to focus on these issues is not just the time when we have a good economy, but to have a good indicators in place for performance-based budgeting, performance management, is something that you should really have also during the most difficult of times. Because when you're trying to determine which programs to cut, which ones that are essential to keep operating, having data, knowing which is what is working and what is not, is actually extremely beneficial. But there is a level beyond this and a level that we need to go to, beyond just performance management, performance-based budgeting, and that, or performance-based budgeting and performance measurement. That's performance-based management. We are the legislative branch, not the executive branch, and the executive branch has made some strides in this area. But one of the things that we have found in our efforts in ways and means in previous years on performance-based budgeting was some agencies basically would detail out a couple of people or a half a person or a half an FTE to comply with our key performance measures. That's as far as it would actually go. There was no integration of those measures into how agencies were operated. There was no integration into how agencies saw its mission. Really, this has to become a uniform, seamless operation between measuring performance, between using it as a legislative branch in terms of how we are budgeting, and also in terms of how the executive branch manages agencies. Senator Morse and I have both indicated that there are some issues with this bill, and there may be a few people in this room that are concerned about some of the portions of this bill. I think we are both prepared to actually work on this bill and bring forward a bill that hopefully will receive broad support in both the House and the Senate. At this particular juncture, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we need to do some more work on this bill, get it to Ways and Means. And I hate to say this, Madam Chair, it is well within the purview of the Rules Committee, but in all reality, this is a Ways and Means bill. This is on performance. This is on performance issues. This is on tracking the performance of agencies. This is crucial to how we follow out our budgeting process, and it is crucial to how we serve Oregonians in this state.
Thank you, Senators, for your testimony. I just had a question. What are the implications of this bill for school districts? I see school districts mentioned, but I can't tell if it applies to them or only some services that they contract for.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we have a lot of money that flows through the state legislature through the budgeting process to essentially contracted services. The intent was to open that door for legislative fiscal, our resources, to go beyond into those organizations eventually and actually look at the performance. And that's an accountability. It's a linkage that I think is missing. And when the bill was drafted, that was the intent, was to open the door for legislative fiscal to actually look at performance of those agencies, parts of local and state government, or not county government, that receive money, and to look at how well that they're performing. And through that process, maybe raise the bar a little higher for those agencies to think about how will they enter into a program of continuous improvement.
Madam Chair, I think there are some aspects of this bill that we will be working on, but I think the reality that Senator Morse has indicated is K-12 is one amongst many. In fact, the vast majority of the dollars that we appropriate to various programs goes out to those programs basically with little strings attached to those appropriations, whether it's dollars in education or whether it's dollars in human services going to counties. Now, I could have the counties behind me, too, here pretty soon. But I think what we want to get is a better handle on when we spend money, are we getting the results that we were intended, that we wanted to get? And as you make difficult choices, I mean, I'll refer back to the Attorney General, who's talked a lot sometimes about drug and alcohol programs. He's more than willing to see funds, and he thinks funds should be invested heavily in drug and alcohol programs because drug and alcohol issues are one of the primary drivers of criminal justice issues in this state. But it makes no sense to invest money in drug and alcohol programs that don't work. What you need to do is to find the programs that do work and invest your dollars there.
Thank you. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you both very much for being here. And we do have two more people signed up, but I see that we have been joined by Senator Starr on another matter, so I will temporarily close the public hearing on Senate Bill 676, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 739. And Erin, please tell us about this bill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 739 requires Legislative Assembly to maintain reports of legislative committee witnesses and post reports on legislative website. The committee did receive written testimony from Janice Thompson at Common Cause in support of the measure.
Thank you, and welcome Senator Starr, and welcome Senator Atkinson.
Thank you, Chair and member of the committee. For the record, Jason Atkinson, representing a good portion of Southern Oregon. Working with Senator Starr, we had a conversation last summer about a word that we talk a lot about here in the building, which is transparency. And we talked quite a bit about how the legislature in our time here, same class as you, Chair Rosenbaum, has changed and changed in terms of the use of computer, email, and now having streaming on the Internet. I brought to this testimony my iPad. I'm not really an early adopter. I'm usually an adopter of new technology about on the second generation when it's been proven. But this device here has, within the last 10 months, changed the legislature entirely. And this bill that we bring to you today is based on that change in technology. So often, bills come up for hearings, and people are able to go to the website and look at bills, look at bill history, look at bill sponsors, look at amendments to bills, but they are not able to see online who is testifying before and against those bills. What this bill states to do is to use technology. It doesn't say iPad, but Senator Starr and I envision something like this, as we have people sign up to testify for bills so that automatically as bills are heard, argued, and as they establish a legislative history, we know who has the public knows who has testified for and against those bills. I think the public would be very interested to know how many lobbyists will be hired for a variety of contracts or lit to kill or to pass various pieces of legislation. And so, Madam Chair, it is with that we brought this bill to the committee based on good governance and, quite honestly, the last piece of transparency or maybe a major flaw in our effort to be more transparent that is not yet concluded. And so with that, I'd be delighted to pass it over to my friend and colleague, the most interesting man in the world, Senator Starr.
Wow.
Well, with that introduction, whoa. Welcome to the Rules Committee. We can't wait to hear what you have to say.
I'm not sure I want to say anything now. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I am the senator that has the privilege of representing most of Western Washington County, and I am here to testify in support of this important piece of legislation. As the senator from Southern Oregon mentioned, we do talk a lot about transparency in this process. It's been a word that we've batted around a lot in the last Well, in the last several years. And, you know, we are moving to a new technological age in the legislature. I think that we're going to continue to do that. More and more of us are carrying our iPads or our laptops with us from committee room to committee room, from floor back to our offices. More and more of us are moving to a paperless system. And I see this particular proposal is moving the legislature in that technological direction. Relatively simple to accomplish. The technologies would be seamless for the most part. Members of the public, members of the lobby would use a stylus, much like we use at a grocery store, sign their name, mark for and against, and almost instantaneously that information can be uploaded onto a legislative website and provide the public clear indication of who's supporting or opposing various pieces of legislation. It would provide the public a window into whether, you know, there's a lot of opposition or the opposition or a lot of support for. It would provide the public ideas about if the support or opposition to legislative proposals are coming from particular areas of the state. There's really just a plethora of information that would be garnered, I believe, by the public if we were to move forward with this proposal, if the legislature were to adopt this particular transparency measure. It's not very complicated. And in the long run, not very expensive either. And I think it's an important step that we ought to move forward with. So with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the hearing on the measure. I would ask that you consider it favorably and move it to the full Senate so that we can have a Senate vote and move this process along. Thank you very much.
Thank you both for your testimony. Are there questions? Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Starr, how quickly would the bill direct that this be done?
I don't know that we have it in the bill how quickly it would be done, but my expectation would be, provided this legislature were to pass it, the Legislative Administration Committee, upon which I serve, could take the process that's necessary in order to get the technology. I don't know if we would be ready for next February, but I would expect that we certainly would be ready for the 77th Legislative Assembly.
And currently, we do actually obviously have this information, and it is available to the public, but only upon request, is my understanding.
Correct.
It looks like the bill calls for names of people, which is what is sitting in front of me on these bills right now, who testify, and then also in addition, if they're representing an entity, is the language that the bill calls for. People don't always identify themselves, obviously, as representing anybody but themselves when they're individuals. We heard a lot of people.
Well, clearly we as legislators understand that when you have a member of the lobby that's sitting in front of us, for the most part, we understand, you know, that lobbyist is being paid and representing an entity. That's what we're targeting there. We don't expect that Joe Citizen that walks in off the street to support or oppose a particular bill is representing anyone other than themselves. But when you have a person that's being paid to represent someone, I think that piece of information is important for the public to understand. And that's why, again, it's a transparency measure where the public will know whether Corporation X or Union Y is supporting a particular legislative proposal.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Starr, just reports of witnesses. Are you talking about the materials that's handed in, or a transcript of their testimony, or summary of?
No, what we're looking for is name. Basically the sign-in sheet that people signed today.
That's it?
We basically want to get that, and we want to get it online. And the technology, Senator Atkinson talked about, he showed his iPad. The technology is relatively simple. You could have an electronic sign-in pad that folks would sign in and identify who their client is or who they're representing. And almost instantaneously, that information can be uploaded and available to the public.
But nothing more than that.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I would, to a certain extent, all the rest of it is public record, and if folks want to, they can dig in and get it. But what we're talking about is a transparency measures that demonstrates to the public who is opposed and in favor of particular pieces of legislation as it relates to the public testimony process that we as legislators enjoy virtually every day during the legislative session.
Madam Chair.
Senator Farrelly.
I think there are some relatively low-tech options for this. For instance, when the staff picks up the sign-up sheets, to drop those onto a flatbed scanner and input them directly into the committee record and post that directly to the Internet would in fact, inform those following on the Internet or by whatever electronic devices they follow, almost concurrent with this committee chair seeing those documents. And it would not be much greater a matter of than the formalities that we currently use to ask people if they, when they're introducing themselves, simply to say, if you're here representing another, name that party. And that way you've got a concurrent record and a verbal record that would allow people to know who's here. I think, Madam Chair, that it might make this process more interesting for people to follow online.
Okay, thank you for that.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Atkinson.
Could I just make one historical note here? In the people who have represented the area that I now have the privilege of representing in the Senate, there was a character, a very celebrated character that many of you remember, named Mr. Debs Potts. Mm-hmm. And Debs was in the Senate before open meetings law, and he used to have in his top drawer a tape recorder with tapes. And he would put the tape in, and he would push record, and he would hold his own hearing on bills up in his office. And he would say, I would now open the committee on such and such, and we're going to hear the bill, and apparently there's no one here to testify, and shut the bill and kill the bill. And he used to go up there in his office and on the record through the tape kill bills all the time. And then we finally changed a few things due to Mr. Potts. One was whether or not the governor was still the governor of Oregon when he was outside the boundaries of the state. And two was the in-sweeping legislation of open meetings laws. This really should be classified as an open meetings law because this is the last piece of reporting to the public just who is involved in decision making. And I think it should be timely and relevant, and I think it should be done instantaneously because everything else here is instantaneously. We did not have laptops on the floor of the Senate until the remodel, if you recall. It was against the rules to have laptops on the floor. We did not have laptops and paperless until about 18 months ago as an option. This is the next step.
Yeah, it certainly seems like we're in a transition process, although in my experience, some information is available instantaneously and some information a little bit less so. So like all transitions, they don't happen seamlessly, but
Madam
certainly
Chair,
seems like we're moving in that direction. Yes, Senator Farrelly.
We still have not improved on the instantaneous transmission of information that occurs. As people understand that in this building, a secret is something that is told to one person at a time. It seems like it moves pretty instantaneously through the building.
Thank you, Senator Farrelly. Thank you very much for bringing this bill. And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 739 and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 676 and call Michael Jordan and Fred King if you'd like to come forward. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee. I think we will be seeing you again shortly. So
I'll be very careful today.
Go ahead, Fred.
All I have to do is find my notes and we'll be all right. Ah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Fred King, and I'm the chair for the Committee on Performance Excellence. This committee was put into law in 2008 with two of you as sponsors for this bill, so I'm here because of your previous actions. I quote from Senate Bill 1099, "The purpose of this legislation is to create a process that will oversee the journey to excellence and will encourage the most vital aspects of Oregon state government to be managed at a world-class level." And continuing on in that bill, the mission of the Committee on Performance Excellence is to assist state agencies in reaching performance excellence by providing policy review, recognition, and recommendations. The committee shall focus on the following areas that define performance: customer and market focused, human resources, leadership, measurement, analysis, and knowledge management, process management, results, strategic planning. This bill put in place a very unique committee that, as far as I know, has never been done before. It has representatives from all three branches of government, representatives from SEIU, AFSCME, and two of us from the public sector, both business people. We met for over 2 years, every month, for a full day. Not 1 or 2 hours, but long days with in-between readings and workings. This was dedicated in a focus group. We had others who also took their time out of their busy schedule to spend many of these days with us. Example of this would be like Gary Blackmer from the Secretary of State's office, as well as Pamela Valencia from Internal Audits. We were staffed by LFO and BAM, and their insights were taken into account. If you look at the list, we had a broad range of professionals. That's the first page there, by the way, our first four pages. If you look at the list, we had a broad range of professionals, people within agencies, consultants, professors, and others with expertise, and those who are actually dealing with these problems. From these meetings and our continuous review, we came up with a one-pager for you to review. This is the second handout that outlines what we feel are the problems and solutions. We are trying to keep it simple. The third handout is a performance management cycle that's nationally recognized. The points we outline and tweaked over time are slowly coming to fruition. Some of these changes can be seen with the leadership of the governor, who's put in place as COO for the state, that is being held accountable for the operation of the state agencies. It sits to my right. Unfortunately, this is not an easy task. The signals are mixed between the branches of government. There are many actions that need fixing that you probably don't have the time to listen to, as you've heard of them most of the years. What is needed is a legislative piece that will institutionalize the connection of continuous improvement and performance management, and that will facilitate this new culture. This will better help you do your jobs as well as everyone else do theirs. It will also help the gain of trust of Oregonians that their money is being spent, is being watched, and getting the results they're being asked for. No matter whether one is a D, R, or a non-affiliate, we all want to know what results and what improvements their money is buying. Senate Bill 676 will put in place a more succinct manner of these expectations and needs so we can have a more common ground from which all of us can work from. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you. I don't see any.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Ferrioli, yes.
Yes.
Are the committee members aware that we have apparently 4,000 unfilled FTEs? And what would the committee's recommendations be on this 4,000 unfilled FTEs?
Well, I think the biggest thing we would probably say is that capacity, in regards to performance measures, one of the things you have to look at is capacity. And when you've got 4,000 FTEs as an example, and that's the fixation in regards to that, the other part of it is let's take a look at how we can make the current processes and the current agencies
efficient, more efficient, more performance manageable, and let the agencies with the CEO start attacking those particular activities. I get going on this, so I have to calm down for a second. If the focus is on FTEs, I think that's the wrong focus. I think the focus needs to be on the processes themselves that are being run in the agencies across the many and myriad silos that are bumping into each other, that maybe you don't need as many FTEs as that are currently being demanded. That's what the CEO, those kinds of questions that would be demanding from him. I know from what information that we have, there is a need to have process management, there's a need to have performance management, there needs to have measurable results, so you don't necessarily have as many of these 4,000 FTEs possibly that are needed in state government.
Madam Chair, I'm not sure I got my, I'm not sure I made my question clear enough to get at the issue that I was interested in. Currently, Oregon is limited to 1.5% of the population for total employment, which puts us quite a bit, quite a ways over the total census that we currently have. But even though there fewer than the statutory limitation of total employees, we have 4,000 positions in state government that have been unfilled, we think, for longer than 6 months. And I just wondered, you know, if you have unfilled positions, how are they being used by agencies as a shock absorber for budgetary management? Are they being kept unfilled for fiscal reasons or policy reasons? Are they truly not needed and could and should be eliminated immediately? Currently we're not under any hiring freeze. Just curious to know, has your committee, which was impaneled in 2009, had any discussions about the incongruity of having, you know, the worst recession we've had in ever, and having, you know, agencies carry on the books fully funded, unfilled positions, 4,000 of them? Is there been any discussion of that at all in the concept of continuous improvement or recommendations from agencies on how they can do things better, faster, cheaper?
The recommendations in regards to the agencies were focused on, let's get a CEO in place who can actually start demanding from the agencies performance measures and accountability. That was one of the first things that we discussed. Also, in regards to the budgetary process, connecting the budgetary process in regards to results. When you started getting down, at least from our end, when we started getting down and trying to drive down and drill down into other areas, we kept getting a finding that there was a more desirable need for communication, bigger picture kinds of stuff, I guess you'd say, because when you start looking at FTEs for every one of the agencies now, you can, you know, that's what the agencies and the CEO is supposed to be doing. We didn't drive all the way down into those kinds of numbers. We just knew that there had to be, from information that we had gotten from people, that there had to be inefficiencies already in there because people were bumping into each other. There was nothing, a process that would go across silos. That's a good question, and personally, I think that's a question that would be demanded from the CEO. No offense to passing the buck here, but that's where we came up with. It became a overwhelming type of activity as we're starting to look at all this.
And thank you. Question, Madam Chair.
Yes, we do have another committee that is trying to get the room, but
just
we have
a word or two about what you perceive the corporate culture to be within agencies?
The what?
Corporate culture.
I think it resides within three areas. One, there's risk aversion. Don't want to take any risk because you're going to get in trouble. that there's a culture of people in there who really want to make a difference, who really want to change things and make things better. There's absolutely, I went in there with one idea, and I've come out after 2 years of talking to a lot of people. There's a lot of good people who want to make a lot of changes to the betterment. But they're bumping, again, they're bumping into each other. And the third one is because there's no real straight line of vision that goes from the top down, from the bottom up, that just that alone creates a culture of misunderstanding, a culture of not understanding what the needs and wants are, not only within the agencies, but from the legislators themselves. And that is, I think, creating tensions and creating a lockup to a certain degree. And that has to change.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Jordan. I am the acting director at DAS and chief operating officer for the state. I'll see you in a couple of weeks to see if I make it beyond acting. I'm really here just to support the bill. I've given you some written comments and also a copy of the bill with some rather crude strikeouts and added language. I apologize for that, but I'm now in my fourth day and I haven't quite gotten up to speed on legislative process. But the real essence of what I'd like to say is that we are prepared in my office and in the agencies of state government to work with Senator Morris and Ways and Means and the legislature put a different budgeting system in place for state government. And that will take us time. There is no doubt about it. One of the reasons behind the changes we've suggested is that we'd like to take the concepts that are in the first few sections of the bill and move them into Section 5, which is requires us to bring a plan to the legislature by the end of this calendar year. We think that's a doable outcome. We're a little concerned that there are some pieces in the first few sections that we do not have the capability to deliver on in the time frame. So under the heading of trying not to overpromise and underdeliver, we'd like to make the work doable, but we're committed to continue to work with Senator Morse and Ways and Means to make this happen, because my charge here, quite frankly, from the governor, is to change the budget system, turn it into a performance strategic-based budget, working with the policymakers, yourselves in the governor's office, to have it align with the outcomes that this body wants to achieve. To be honest, the budget now is very difficult to find out where we're expending our resources, where we're prioritizing our resources, and how they fit into any kind of strategic direction. So I just wanted to commit my support and the agency support to on the bill and get it into a workable fashion, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your hard work on this. And we will look forward to seeing you back, Mr. Jordan, in a couple of weeks.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you both. And with nothing further to come before us, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 676, and we are adjourned.